Hello and welcome to the Spa Girls podcast, the self-publishing podcast for authors. You're in the right place for the best writing, marketing and publishing advice, plus interviews with industry experts and best-selling authors. I'm Shar Barrett.
I'm Cheryl Phipps.
I'm Wendy Valla.
And I'm Trudy J. Welcome to the Spa. This week we have an awesome guest. We've got Honey Phillips.
Hey!
Hey, welcome, Honey. Hi. Now, Honey is an awesome sci-fi romance author, and we're super excited to chat with you about everything to do with sci-fi romance today. I don't think we might have had one other person who was sci-fi alien romance before, but I think this is you're a unique among our guests, so we're very excited to have you here. I'm going to read out your bio, and then we're going to get right into the questions, so be prepared for a lot of interrogation.
How to make the guests feel comfortable with three easy lessons.
Don't worry about her.
Okay. USA Today bestselling author Honey Phillips writes steamy science fiction romance about hot alien warriors and the earth women they can't resist. From abductions to invasions, the ride might be rough, but the end is always satisfying. Honey wrote and illustrated her first book at the tender age of 5. Her writing has improved since then. Her drawing skills, unfortunately, have not. I'm sure they've improved a little bit. Come on. She loves writing, reading, traveling, cooking, and drinking champagne. Not necessarily in that order. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So let's start at the beginning. Like, how did you get into writing and self-publishing in particular? Tell us your journey.
Oh, let's see. Well, I always enjoyed writing, but it was, and I think I went through a period in my sort of, you know, teens where I thought about being a writer, which in my mind was in capital letters. And I had, you know, books on craft and, you know, Stephen King's books on writing and, you know, all of that sort of thing. I even have books on how to submit queries. And I looked at that and I thought, that sounds really hard. And, you know, then life happened and I was working and I had a daughter and I was just busy. And so I never really did much with it. And then 2009-ish, I did NaNoWriMo. And I sat down and I wrote a book in a month. And I was like, oh, I can actually do this. I had started, I think, 2 before, and I never quite got them finished. And with NaNoWriMo, I realized I actually could finish a book. And I learned the secret for me is that instead of agonizing about every sentence, I got to a place that I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I put in 3 X's and I kept going. And I still, to this day, continue to do that. And so I enjoyed it very much. I finished it. I put it aside and I didn't do anything else until the next year. And that went on for quite a few years. And somewhere in there, and I think it was around 2013, I actually wrote Anna and the Alien, which turned out to be the one that I eventually published. I finished it. I liked it. I wrote 2 more, or most of 2 more, in camp RIMOs. And again, you know, I started looking at self-publishing. I kind of thought about it. I figured out how to format it into a MOBI format and put it aside again. And then sometime in, I guess it was 2018, I started thinking about what's going to happen in the future. My husband's a good bit older than me, and he was getting ready to retire. And I thought, what am I going to do when he retires? I'm going to keep working because I had a fairly demanding corporate job. But maybe, because I'm pretty sure at that point I had gotten into the 20 books group, maybe if I just put out a book, see how it does, and then over the years, it'll kind of build up. And when he retires, a few years later, maybe I could retire and I'd have a little supplemental income. So I put up Anna and the Alien, and then I did Beth and the Barbarian, and they did really pretty well right from the start. And within a year, I had equaled my corporate salary.
Wow. Yeah, you, so. I remember you in 2018 in the 20 books group, just saying.
And I did, at first, you know, I kind of posted in there a couple of times, and then I started feeling kind of, you know, my family is British and I have this, you do not talk about how well you do in, you know, ingrained in me, and you never talk about money. And so those two things are like voices in my head all the time. And I started feeling weird about it. So I stopped doing it. But yeah, and I kept going and it kept doing better. And I still continue to hang on to the corporate job. So I was doing both. And then, and then the pandemic hit, and in the January of 2021, my family came down with COVID, and including my husband, and I'm going to cry. I really thought he was going to die. And, you know, he was hospitalized. It wasn't that bad. He wasn't even intubated, but just, you know, when I had to leave him there and I thought I was never going to see him again. And I told you I was going to cry.
It's okay. No, you got us going too. I can feel
I can't even, I just can't even imagine.
No, I can't even imagine.
And, you know, after that, I just realized, why am I still holding on to this job? Yes, it's nice that it has benefits. It's nice that it's a guaranteed salary. It's nice that it has retirement, but it doesn't make me happy. And it was a job that I had loved for a long time. I no longer loved it. I was tired of sitting in Zoom meetings where people just wanted to repeat something that somebody else had said. I mean, you guys probably know corporate, certainly corporate America is like that. And so I finally quit, and I have never been here.
Oh, that's so good.
Wow. When did you quit? When did you finish your job?
I quit in April of 2021. So
not really. Congratulations.
Yeah. I hung on to that for a long time because I was very loyal to the company. I've been with them a long time, but it just, my team changed, the people changed, the atmosphere changed. They were very sympathetic at first after we were having these issues. And then within a month, it was like, well, you should be over this and get back to work. And I just wasn't feeling it. And I was exhausted. I mean, I had the, you know, 6 weeks after having COVID, I was still just tired all the time. And I thought something's got to give, and it was going to be that, not the writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Wow. And how's it been going since then? Like, has it
taken off?
Well, you know, I had this idea that after I quit, I would suddenly magically have a whole lot more time.
Everyone says that. Everyone.
I think because I've always been kind of a multitasker. So I was used to doing, you know, if I'm in a Zoom meeting, I might also be, I can listen, but I could do a graphic at the same time, that kind of thing. And you also kind of adapt your time to fit what you've got. So it didn't magically turn into a whole lot more time. I have been more productive, maybe a little too productive. I did 14 books last year.
Oh, my crikey.
18 this year. I will caveat that by saying, obviously, some of these are shorter. But, you know, an 18 this year was good up until about September. And from September through right now, I'm tired. So, you know, December comes around, I am not writing anything for a month and just taking a break.
Good for you. Awesome. You deserve it. So how long are these books in general? Because I get the sense that they're going to be different.
They do. They vary a lot. I have ones that probably my longest right now are in the sort of 60K range. And then I've been doing some of the shorter series, and those are in the more sort of 30 to 35 range.
Okay.
And I just did a monster romance, like you mentioned earlier, and the monster romance, we had a limit on that of 20K because we were trying to get into the 2-hour short reads.
Okay. That was a box set or was it a...
No, it was just a collaboration. So everybody, we had 12 authors. It was called Monster Between the Sheets, and we did it just before Halloween. We have these adorable illustrated covers done by Elle Christensen, who's one of the authors in the group. And it was just a lot of fun, and it was kind of, I enjoyed being on Earth. I mean, I had an alien invasion series, which is on Earth, but most of my books don't take place on Earth. So it was kind of fun to be back on Earth and in, you know, sort of the regular environment. And it was just the title of the book is Extra Virgin Gargoyle, which I thought was a great title.
Gargoyle,
I
did not know the title of that.
And it's just, you know, it's just a fun series, and they've all done really well. So
that's really cool. Because you've done a few of those. I want to talk to you about those a bit later in the interview, because I saw another one that you were, I think your book was called Sinter in it, and it was a series of different
books. That's coming out on Friday.
Ah, there you go. Okay, and that's another one where it's like multiple authors in the same series, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So
yes.
I'm really keen to talk about that. I'm interested in that, the logistics and things like that of that one. But okay, if we can start first talking a little bit about what exactly is sci-fi romance / alien romance, and is there a difference there? And just get some general kind of ideas of what that means, like what it, and actually what made you write sci-fi romance? Like, was that just what you've been reading, or where did it come from?
Okay, where to start?
Sorry, I asked all the questions all at once because that's how
that's
excited
okay.
I am.
Let me start where with where I came to it from.
Yeah.
So I have always been a voracious reader. I mean, ever since I was, you know, probably 4 years old. And I love science fiction. I started off with kind of more fantasy, you know, little kids like, you know, E. Nesbitt and, you know, some of the sort of magical kind of fantasy, especially English fantasy novels, and discovered Andre Norton at an early age, who I loved and still think is amazing. So I really like science fiction, read a huge amount of science fiction, including classic science fiction, belonged to the science fiction book club of the month kind of thing. But at some point, probably around my 20s, I got tired of the fact that almost all of the heroes were male, and started reading more fantasy. And then fantasy became, you know, went from single books to trilogies to a zillion books in a series, and sort of moved into urban fantasy and paranormal and that kind of stuff. But, you know, always, I think, almost always with kind of a fantastical element to it. And then when I got my Kindle, it opened up a whole new world for me, because before that, I tended to reread books because I was just running out of space. But once I got the Kindle, I realized there's a whole lot more books that I probably wouldn't even have seen in a bookstore. And so I rediscovered how much I enjoyed romance and read a lot of the, what I would say was science fiction romance available at the time. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And that's basically what I've been doing ever since. Okay. And so science fiction romance to me is something that involves regular, for me, it involves a regular person and an other world that is at least on the surface technology, involves technology which is outside of our realm. That's a pretty fine line. Mm-hmm. You know, I read Anne McCaffrey, I read the short story that was the beginning of her Pern series, and it certainly never would have occurred to me that that was in any way science fiction. I just assumed it was fantasy.
She turned it into science fiction because it was never,
she turned it into
fantasy
fiction.
And then it,
yes,
the origin story is science fiction. Yeah.
Exactly. And even today, if I started writing about dragons, which I might, it would be fantasy to me unless there was, you know, they're coming from this planet where they are, it's a dragon planet kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it incorporates a pretty wide range. I mean, there are people who write more space operas. There are people where humans are already out in space and you're on spaceships and, you know, there's like a galactic federation. There's cyborg romance, which is, so these are kind of like subgenres within science fiction romance, but the, in my opinion, and I think based on the Amazon charts, the most popular kind of science fiction romance is alien romance.
Yeah. So that's a shub. So the sci-fi romance covers everything. And then the alien romance is a subgenre within that. And there are other ones that you could like. Yeah.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Yeah. And so it's because I grew up a similar thing. Like I had fantasy and science fiction books and I was the same. I always used to love it when I had a female protagonist for once in some of those books. And now we've got this is why I love self-publishing, because now we've got all this alien romance and sci-fi romance, and suddenly romance authors are able to kind of get in there and and actually put some books out that romance readers love to read that maybe never would have gotten out there before, do you think? Like, is that as a long-term reader?
I think so, because, I mean, it's not that there wasn't science fiction romance before, but it was always, trying to think of a way to put this that doesn't sound begrudging, but I think that traditional publishing accepted a certain level of romance in science fiction, but it was always pushed down. Mm-hmm. You know, Anne McCaffrey wrote several books that are definitely science fiction romance, but the romance on the whole tends to get kind of pushed down. Whereas with my books and the books that I like to read and which I think are popular in the genre, the romance is first. Wow. Science fiction is the setting, but the emphasis is on the romance and the building of the relationship between the characters.
Yeah, that's cool. And so you're talking about world building there. So I feel like is there a lot, like how much world building do you do in your the sci-fi romance? Does that take a bigger part in your writing process than maybe if it was a contemporary romance, do you think? Or
it depends quite a lot. You know, I wrote Cyborgs on Mars, and for that, I actually spent, you know, a fair amount of time researching what would it take to terraform Mars? What are some of the things that they might do? What level is it that I want it to, do I want that terraforming to be at in order to set up the environment? And I mentioned that in the story, nothing like the amount that I investigated, but it's more... it's a background for what essentially creates a frontier planet. So it's much more kind of like Old West kind of feel, Old West tropes. You know, the horses are mechanical horses. They're not living horses, but although they're somewhat sentient, but they are not, it's still that kind of, you know, it's a ranger sitting on his horse on a bluff overlooking the desert kind of thing, except it's a mechanical horse. It's a cyborg ranger and it's on Mars. And I just love that combination. I like, you know, like Firefly, you know, I love that combination of kind of an Old West feel mixed with technology. Yeah. And so in my books, the setting is more about what is it that contributes to the story? You know, if I have a jungle planet, I'm making up the jungle. I'm not sitting there figuring out, okay, it's this many, you know, miles from the sun, so it would have this kind of climate. I'm, you know, what kind of jungle, what kind of exotic things would occur here that would become part of the story? Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's cool. And so the next thing is, how do you create your aliens? Like, are there things that all the aliens are going to need to have? Like, is there certain aspects to them that are similar across the board, or are you just making up whole new?
Well, they're always big. Yeah. And I mean, big all over. and actually, you know, that is one of the fun parts of creating alien heroes, is that they can have very unique endowments. So that's always fun. Yeah. And other than that, it's really more kind of what drives into the story that I'm writing. And I have a couple of exceptions, but I tend to write series where the alien in each book is different. So it's a different species of alien. And I like that kind of variety because it gives them, you know, different backgrounds, different things they're interested in. We were talking about dragons. I did a dragon alien who, you know, he comes from a very warlike culture, so they set up all these rules where they basically isolate themselves so that they don't kill each other off. You know, so he has a really hard time kind of opening himself up to other people and letting the heroine and her baby into his lair, which you never let anybody into your lair. And, you know, and so it's just kind of, that was the character that needed that kind of background.
So these aliens, do they shift at all, or are they always an alien?
They are, for the most part, from mine, always an alien. I have done an alien shifter, and I'm actually, there's going to be in those series that I was just talking about, the Seven Brides for Seven Alien Brothers, mm-hmm. one of them is going to be a shifter as well. Most of the time, they're alien all the time. I kind of cheated a little bit. I did a tentacle book. I did Kate and the Kraken, and the hero is we'll say a tentacled hero. He's not quite an octopus because he doesn't have eight legs, but he has tentacles, and he has what I call a landform, where his legs basically kind of wrap together to form legs that he can use to walk on land. But they're still tentacles. They're just sort of formed into legs while he's on dry land. Mm-hmm. But shifters, the one and now two, those are the only ones I've done where they're actual shifter. Mm-hmm. I take it back. Cinta, which is the one that's coming out on Friday, he also kind of shifts into a different format.
Okay, cool. And so
it must be so much fun to write. I'm just listening to you talk. I mean, it must be fun sitting down and like just, true creating.
You must have to do a lot of world building and series Bibles and stuff like that, because there would be rules in each series, right? That, you know, if you're building a different world, they have different rules within that world.
You would think I would do things like that. I'm not great on series Bibles, but in my head, it's clear, at least while I'm writing it. If I go back to something, I essentially usually have to go back and reread the previous books to make sure I remember. I'm not good at series Bibles.
Yeah.
But that would be an excellent thing to do, yes.
Just like world creating, you know, laws and all sorts of things going on within that world.
Yeah. Is there, like, how human do they have to be? Like, looking at, like, a lot of your covers, it sort of seems like there's a man chest, but it happens to be blue with a few scales on it. Is that, or are they complete, like, have you got any ones that are just completely not human-esque? Or
I've got... Okay, I'm going to give you a two-part answer to this. First is the cover answer, which is when I started publishing, and maybe even before I started publishing, there was, back in the old days, Amazon used to have boards, reader boards. Mm-hmm. And there was a thread on the Amazon reader boards called Aliens That Look Like Aliens, Romance with Aliens That Look Like Aliens, that Susan Trombley actually started. And what she wanted was not just somebody who looked human, but maybe was a different color. When I started publishing, you didn't find covers that were like that. In fact, the majority of covers were still, they weren't even colored something different. And then Amanda Milo did the first one that I remember with an alien who didn't actually look human. But even then, you always like saw him from the back. You know, so you might see like a muscular back with, you know, a ridge of spikes down it. And it was very difficult. It didn't seem like anybody really wanted to look at a cover with an obviously alien looking hero. I think Monster Romance has changed that. And I have some other thoughts on that. But for me, with my books, and I mean, I have a Minotaur hero. I have a Naga hero. What I try and do is give enough information that a reader who wants to think of them as being really alien has the information there to do it with. Mm-hmm. For somebody who really isn't into that, it's not so in their face that they can't just kind of ignore it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Makes total sense. Yeah.
So the series, are they long? Are they long series or short? What's traditionally, what are they like?
Romance? Most of them, I would say, run in the 5-ish kind of range.
Yeah.
You know, maybe as short as 4, maybe as long as 8, but they tend to run into that sort of length. I'm doing things a little bit different. My alphabet series is up to, what is it up to? It's up to Q. And I'm going to go all the way to Z.
Wow.
And what I do, yes. So what I do with those is I just release 3 a year. And so it's not like somebody, and I try, they are all interconnected standalones, but they're not like super connected. I tend to have little mini arcs within the 3 that I do each year. But you could pick it up at any point and you would not be lost.
Mm-hmm. And this is this the Alien Abduction series?
That's the Alien Abduction.
17 so far in that. Gosh.
Yes, correct.
So you don't do a series Bible for those, and it's different couples each time, but it's just kind of loosely connected in the same world?
It's the same universe. It's called the Khazarian Empire. There are certain rules around it, which is that Earth is a primitive planet. They're not supposed to get people from there, but still, you know, those nasty alien slavers come and pick up human women because we're wonderful and everybody wants one. And they then, most of the adventures take places on different worlds. Now, sometimes it's not. Like the three that I did last summer, which was Olivia and the Orc, Pandora and the Pirate? I can't remember. Pandora and the Prisoner. That's right. And Quinn and the Quella. Those all took place on the same world at the same time, which was actually pretty difficult. And I wish I hadn't done that. But it turned out to be fine. And they mainly take place on the same world. Those stories are pretty connected because the three girls are friends and they were all kidnapped at the same time. So that's kind of like a little mini arc with each of the girls having their adventure, then them all coming back together at the end and, you know, being reunited. And I'm sorry, I think there was another question in there that I lost. So there are rules around that world and how things work and the types of aliens that were in that series.
I'm curious about, like, so we've talked sort of, you've got kidnapping as a trope and it's an alien with a Earth woman. Is that generally the way it is? Is that a very common, like, is it most sci-fi / alien romance would be alien with a human woman?
Yeah, so, it's almost always a human female and an alien male. A couple of people have done it the other way. It does not generally seem to be as popular. And I think it's because, you know, if it's a human female, it's easier to put yourself into her shoes. You know, so when you're reading it, you have a reason to say, oh, I've never been to this place before. What does it look like? You know, this is a new experience for me. Oh, you know, you can say, I miss McDonald's, and people understand that. If you're an alien female, it's a little bit more difficult to do that. So readers, I don't think, can put themselves in their shoes. That's not to say people don't do it. They do. But the most of the ones that are more popular tend to be human female.
I think logistically, when we're talking of the things that aliens and humans do, I think it makes sense too, don't you? Think that it should be a woman?
Not necessarily. Like, they might. Yeah. Anyway, you're talking logistics, right? Of
yes, intimacy. You're talking about intimacy. Yeah.
So are there any other kind of common tropes or universal fantasies that people are looking for when they're reading sci-fi romance? Like, what are the big kind of, like, that one? I think, to me, it's not just logistics or how hard it is to write an alien female. In my mind, it's that it's kind of escapist to imagine that there's this big, hot alien dude who just wants you and, well, you know, like the kidnapping thing. You know, like that whole kind of angle seems way more fun and exciting to me as a reader than the other way around. I don't know. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that it's very much a question of, you know, you had mentioned, you know, Theodora Taylor and the Universal Fantasy. So you're being taken away from your everyday life, you know, and that most of the time is not a great life. You know, I mean, there are some exceptions to that, but, you know, it's your average everyday life. Maybe you don't have a boyfriend, or the boyfriend or husband that you have is kind of a jerk. You know, you have to work. It's, you know, it's rainy, whatever it is, you don't have a great life. And so being pulled out of that is definitely, I think, something that appeals to people. I think that almost always, and again, there are exceptions to all of these, almost always, the alien male is going to be really fixated. You know, it's like, you know, the paranormal equivalent of fated mates. You know, they're, even if it's not instantaneous, there's very much a very strong attraction almost immediately. And of course, they're big and strong and powerful. They can protect you. And well, in real life, we may be like, I could do just fine by myself. In fantasy, it's really nice to have somebody who's going to take care of you, you know, and protect you. And, you know, you can have some of the same tropes that you have in regular romance. You can have him buying you beautiful clothes that may or may not fit. It has come up in maybe not buying, but, you know, I like a scene where the heroine gets really dressed up sometimes. Mm-hmm. Fairly seductively, but I do like the heroine getting dressed up. You know, you can go to exotic locations. It's an escape, just like you said. At least that's what I write. I want an escape.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so are there any other kind of common tropes? Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think what else it might be.
Well, there's, in probably 90% of the books, there's always a baby log that somehow magically, despite the fact that we are of different species and different sizes and different anatomy, we are capable of reproducing. So, you know, this is sort of a joke that human women are like universal breeders, but there's definitely almost always a baby log. In my books in particular, there's almost always a found family element. You know, it's making a new family. Some of the series are much more focused on that than others. But, you know, and it's family that may look different, they may act different, but it's still part of your family. And I think that sort of message of acceptance also really resonates with a lot of readers.
Yeah, agreed. And it also, for me as a reader, gets around the, you know, how would you feel about leaving your family behind and never seeing them again if you're on a different planet kind of thing? Whereas if you're glad not to see them again, then it just helps me skip that part.
Yeah. And that's why you see a lot of orphans.
Yeah.
There are a lot of orphans or people who are estranged from their parents, because that is, you know, obviously that is a concern. And it's having to balance, you know, what's the level of reality. You can't completely disregard reality, but what's the level of reality that I can accept without getting really dark? And definitely think over the last 4 years, I have lightened up somewhat because there are some realities that we don't like to think about. And I touched on them a couple of times. And even my readers who read dark romance don't really want to read dark romance for me. So,
yeah.
Yeah, at least try to come up with a rational way around it most of the
time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Can we touch a little bit on your marketing and stuff? Do you have a Facebook group? Do you have people, you know, like groups seem to be the way, but do you have something like that?
I have a Facebook group, which is, you know, it's a reader group. I have a Facebook page and a Facebook profile. I technically have a TikTok account, although I post about once every couple of weeks at most. I'm not a big TikTok person. I have an Instagram account. I don't post there very often. I am not great at marketing, I don't think. I do have a newsletter list. I have about 16,500 people on my newsletter list, so that definitely helps. I don't send a lot of... I don't think I send a lot of newsletters. I send one when I have a new release. That's one of the things we were talking about at RAM, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I should send newsletters more often. But right now it's when I have a release, which is, you know, usually at least once a month.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've got 18 releases, so that's not a...
Probably
it's not like there's a big gap between the newsletters.
Yeah.
I do a little bit of Facebook advertising. I do a little bit of Amazon advertising. I do a little bit of BookBub advertising. I wouldn't say that I am tremendously successful at any of them. And, you know, at some point it's almost like a habit. It's like you do it and you don't really know that it makes any difference, but you really don't want to turn it off just in case it really is making a difference.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about foreign translations? Do you get into that at all, or...?
I have just started. So I did. I'm starting with the Alien Abduction series, and I'm releasing one every 2 months because I found a translator who was recommended to me, partly because I was intimidated by the whole business of going to Upwork and, you know, getting multiple people and then trying to have them proofread and decide which one was the best one. And this was somebody who's recommended to me. I think she's very good. It takes her 2 months to do a book. So I'm only doing one every 2 months. And I also, Lee Savino has a publishing company that does some translations. So one of my series I'm doing through her, and she's doing those wide. So that's going to be interesting to see how the wide ones do compared to the ones that I'm doing, which are in Kindle Unlimited. Mm.
That'll be a good experiment, that one. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is sci-fi romance, does anyone go wide with that, or is it mostly a KU kind of thing, do you think?
It's primarily KU. There are some outliers. I mean, you know, somebody like Grace Goodwin or Mina Carter, I mean, people who have been around, Vanessa Vale to a certain extent, people who have been around longer, I think, are more likely to be wide. I also think some of the subgenres are likelier to be wide. So like cyborg romance, I think, is one that is more likely to be wide. Just the straight alien romance, like I write, I think is more likely to be KU. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Ruby Dixon being the queen of KU and alien romance, I think kind of really helped to establish that niche.
Mm-hmm. So did you see a boost in sales when TikTok got a hold of Ruby's books? Or
I think I did. I didn't notice it directly, but the last half of last year was certainly a good, I had a really good year last year. And the last, it started with the Exposed to the Elements that did really well. So the year got off to a good start. And then the last half of the year after my alien abduction books came out did really well. And I do think, looking back on it, that may have been at least in part due to Ruby getting that huge boost. Mm. Hard to tell when every single book and the top everything is Ruby Dixon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, if anybody deserved it, she does, because she just, you know, she writes so much. I mean, I write a lot, but I don't write anywhere near the number of words that she writes. She is just amazing.
Mm. That's awesome. So let's talk about that. Like, how much do you write a day? Like, what are some of your processes? Are you a plotter or a pantser also?
I am a pantser, and I am, I think the latest term that Becca Syme has come up with this is a phoenix writer, which means that I'm also high intellection, so I have to think about a story. And what that tends to mean is I go days without writing, and then all of a sudden I sit down, usually when the deadline approaches, I sit down and I just do nothing but write for 3 days or 4 days or 5 days or however long it takes me to finish the book. And I mean, literally I do nothing else, including sleep most of the time.
See, that sounds way better than binge writer. I like that. Phoenix writer.
Well, it went from binge writer to seasonal writer and now this phoenix term. And it does kind of feel like that, because at least in my case, it's like that the egg is sort of growing and then it sort of explodes and I write it all down and then everything is ashes and I have to recover and start over again.
Yeah,
I haven't had quite as much time as I wanted to recover this fall, but I'm getting
there. Guessing you've got a lot of strategic strengths there.
I'm like learner, intellection, input, relator, achiever, and that's the only ones I remember, but it's very high strategic.
Yeah,
that's interesting. And anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, this is the Clifton Strengths by and Becca Syme, who helps people or writers interpret those Clifton Strengths. So if you've been under a rock and don't know anything about it.
It's kind of funny at RAM that almost everybody who introduced themselves either started by mentioning their strengths or actually having a slide that showed their strengths.
Yeah.
So it's definitely become a very universal author language at this point. And there are still people who are like, I don't do that. But it's pretty common.
I think it's a way of finding acceptance and process in some ways. For me, it is. You know, I'm up there with intellection number one, learner number two, and input number three. And it's like, man, I don't have the achiever like you do. So I just don't get out of my own way. I just sit there whirring without moving. And I think it's a way almost of talking about ourselves or explaining our process without kind of loading it with self-judgment, if you like, because it is what it's just giving a label to process to me. It's not a good or a bad thing. It just is.
Yeah.
So that's what I found. I mean, I think I know myself pretty well. So it wasn't like it was a revelation when I took the class or when I found out the strengths, but it does give you kind of a way to talk to other people.
Yeah. And if you've come from the corporate world where you've got the Myers-Briggs, you know, it's sort of, we've already got our little four things, four letters there anyway.
Yeah. Yes. That's cool. I want to go back to box sets and also the series where one author is writing one of the books. So have you done many of those? How have they gone for you? Do you find that they're useful?
Well, the first one I did was back in 2019, and we did a series, a collaboration. And when I say collaboration, what I mean is that there are several authors involved who each write their own book. And it can, depending on the type of collaboration, can be set in their own world, but there is something that ties them together, usually some kind of universal theme. It might be a setting, and usually there's some kind of common branding as well. So in 2019, I did Cosmic Fairy Tales, and that was a group of authors who were all doing our own spin on fairy tales with a sci-fi twist. And so mine was Jackie and the Giant, and all of the covers were done by the same cover artist. So there was kind of a universal look across them, but they were all set in our own individual worlds. And that was partly because Tiffany Roberts was one of the authors who was in there, and she had been through that with the collaboration that she had done previously, where there was a shared world. And there's a lot involved in trying to make sure that all the pieces match up. You know, when you've got, you know, if you're on a planet, you were talking about a series Bible. If you're on a planet, you know, what do the trees look like? You know, what kind of transportation do they have? If there's a backstory, how does that backstory fit in? So this was just do your own thing, but we'll kind of tie them together as a group project. So that was 2019. And I think the next one,
how did the one in 2019 go? Did it work?
It went really well.
Yeah. Like, I think newsletter subscribers to it, or is it just the cross promotion, you think? Or
I think it was really just the cross promotion. And for some reason, Amazon put my book as the first in the series, which I think maybe helped me. But that book, just as a standalone series book, just it sold really well for a long time, just kind of on its own. And I know, like, Amanda Milo had a book in there, which led into a new series that she's doing. And I think it continued to do really well. So there was definitely, you know, again, it's like anything else. There was varying levels of success. And the more closely books are tied together, the better, I think, the success of one adds to the success of the others. Whereas when they're more loosely tied, it's not necessarily going to be the same for everybody.
Yeah.
So the contrast to that is The Monsters Between the Sheets. And so that's 12 books, all had the same background setup, all had, again, the same cover artist. We released them, I don't know, like 3 days apart over most of October. And all of those books have done well. And I do think that is, and the had a very organized kind of, you know, when this book comes out, you post about it. And just, I think that all of those books have done well. And I think it's because of the fact that they tied together. So all the authors kind of built on each other. Mm. Whereas with the Cosmic Fairy Tales, they did well, but I'm not sure. And most of the science fiction readers probably already knew all of us. So it varied a little bit as far as how well they did. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Total sense. So, do you think there's a strong crossover between monster romance and sci-fi? Like, to me, it fits under the sci-fi banner, but I guess there would be arguments against that as well. I don't know.
That is an excellent question. Because I think there are people who think that monster romance has to be more paranormal, you know, because paranormal was kind of moving to it from the, you know, first you have shifters and vampires, which by most definitions are monsters, and then getting into the more, you know, monstery type monsters. Whereas science fiction romance heroes, a lot of times have a more monstrous appearance. Which may or may not be emphasized on the covers. And so they're coming at it from that side. I mean, to me, monster romance is basically kind of the love child of both of them. You can be in the monstrous because you're an alien. You can be monstrous because you came out of the swamp.
Yeah.
You know, you're still monster.
Literally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Maybe and the so difference that's between Earth-based monsters versus Mars-based monsters. Could it be as literal as that, you know?
It can be, yeah. But, I mean, and then you get into, well, what about fantasy monster romance? You know, where it's maybe more Earth-like, but then there's, and I'm very broadly defining fantasy as having some kind of magic involved. You know, so with paranormal, a lot of times it doesn't necessarily have to have magic. That's just kind of the way the world is. Whereas fantasy, you have the magic and again, broad generalizations, a more, you know, a different type of world. And then you have sci-fi, which has, again, a different type of world, but with a scientific basis rather than magic, which is splitting a very minor hair. But I think you guys understand what I mean.
Yeah. That's awesome. So are there any kind of tips or anything, if someone's thinking of starting out in science fiction romance, what would you advise them to do? Like, where should they start? What should they be thinking about?
I would say, first of all, you know, read in that genre. I think the people who have done, and because it has taken off, there have been some people who have come into it saying, oh, this is, you know, the next big thing. And I'm going to be financially successful by doing it because it's the next big thing. I don't think that works as well as somebody who really reads it and loves it.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got it in your background, you probably already, you know, have that there. If you don't, I would say read, you know.
It's like any genre that you're thinking about writing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at the covers, look at what's popular, read it, and you know, what are the universal fantasies? What are the, like we talked about, you know, what are the elements that work for you? And what works for me might not be what works for somebody else. You know, I write third person. Apparently, sometimes I feel like I'm the only person left on the planet that writes third person, but that's my voice. You know, I don't want to write first person particularly. I like third person. I like dual point of view. Not everybody does. You know, so it's finding your own voice within that niche is what's important, I think. Don't just try and imitate somebody, but figure out how your voice fits in.
Yeah. Great advice.
That's awesome. So I've almost run out of questions. I've got one more. Has anyone else got any other anything?
I think she's pretty much covered it all off. Actually.
You're a superstar. But
absolutely.
So I just want, you know, if there was one piece of advice you could give newbie writers or even just writers out there, what is it? What would you like to tell other self-published writers out there in the world?
Honestly, I mean, I hate to sound like a commercial, but just do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I put it off for so long. I had this book sitting, Anna and the Alien, my first book. I had that sitting out there for 5 years, I think, before I published it. I had that written before Ruby Dixon came out with her first book. You know, it was just sitting there. And I finally had to just say, okay, what are you going to lose? You know, and this is obviously someone who's just beginning, but just do it. If you love it, if you're passionate about it, just go ahead, you know, put it out there. You can learn. There are, you know, you don't have to get $30,000 worth of developmental edits and copy edits and proofread, and you don't have to have your own website, and you don't have to have a marketing plan. I mean, that's the joy of self-publishing, is you can start from almost nothing and just do it and figure it out as you go along.
That's awesome.
Very good advice.
That probably sounds way too simplistic.
No, it's perfect advice. No. It doesn't need to be complex for newbies. They just got to do it.
Sometimes we overcomplicate things when you get started.
100.
That's awesome. Absolutely. Thank you so much, honey. So if someone wants to find you, like not in a scary stalker way, but just in a super fan kind of way, where can you be found? Like, where's the best place to come and check out your books?
Well, obviously, I have a website, which is honeyphillips.com. I'm on Amazon. All of my books right now are in Kindle Unlimited. So obviously, it's easy to find me there. You can look at me on TikTok, but you won't see very much. So my good old-fashioned Facebook profile page. I saw somebody on TikTok going, you know, Facebook is like your grandfather. But I'm like the grandfather still on.
Awesome. Thank you.
Not on Twitter.
Not on Twitter. Okay. Not on Twitter. And Shah, where can we be found?
No, I think there's even less people on Twitter than there was a week ago, anyway, let's not get into that one. We can be found at spargirlspodcast.com, across the internet's on that, and we can be found at patreon.com/spargirlspodcast. If you'd like to support the show, we would really appreciate that.
Awesome. And Shah, do you want to mention YouTube as well? Because I feel like that might be something that you're passionate about.
Yes, it is something I'm passionate about, and we are very close to reaching our goal of 1,000 subscribers on YouTube by the end of 2022. I'm going to put this out there. A handsome, strong alien may visit you should you subscribe to our YouTube channel. And, we're going to do our best to arrange that.
Just do it for us because we're sick of her.
Get that shot off our back.
If you care about us at all,
the other three subscribe
to YouTube.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to get them with honey, and you guys are trying to get them with vinegar. But either way, if you can subscribe at youtube.com, for Spar Girls Podcast.
We'd love you forever.
Love you.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners. We appreciate every single one of you. You're all awesome. And thank you for listening to another episode with us, with the ever delightful Honey Phillips. We will be back again next week with another show. But for now, it's farewell from us.
Bye.
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 Bye.